If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema is a four-weekly podcast which looks at and recommends movies that are more than 20 years old. The good, the obscure, the interesting, and the weird. Feedback is important. You can email it to cultguru with a K at gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U at gmail.com. Visit the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook or leave a recorded voicemail or comment at paleocinema.blogspot.com or drop a voicemail at our new number 206-309-4864. This podcast may contain adult concepts and language, but please don't be disappointed if it doesn't.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 115. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I have a guest from the other side of the Pacific. I've got Rupert Pupkin with me. How are you?
I am great, Terry. Thank you for having me, sir.
That's okay. Do you prefer Rupert or do you want your real name on this?
Rupert's fine. Rupert's fine.
Okay, we'll go with Rupert then. Yeah, so thank you very much for being a part of Paleo Cinema history.
I'm honored. It's been a long time coming. As you know, I've been a fan for quite a while.
You've been a great supporter. I don't see them as people as fans. I see them as supporters and friends, so it's all good there. So, what do you mean? Do you want me to go first with what I've been watching or do you want to go first?
You go right ahead, sir.
I have seen the Star Trek movie, which is out in America.
God damn it.
We got it first.
Very nice. What'd you think?
Yep, so Star Trek Into Darkness. I liked it. I think it's really cool. I could do a spoiler here and piss off half of the planet if I really wanted to. But I'm not going to. I'm going to avoid that. Yeah, I think the ensemble works well. I saw it in 3D, and I think the 3D works really well. Space battles and kind of giant skyscrapers and planets and things like that work really well in 3D.
Cool.
So I think it is worth paying out the extra bucks and putting on the funny glasses to get that going. The cast is pretty good. I'm still not convinced at how good an actor Chris Pine is. I think he's a bit, you know, iffy at times. Zach Quinto, very, very good. Benedict Cumberbatch, fantastic. Simon Pegg gets a bit of a Guernsey in there. And the rest of them kind of stand in the background looking through lens flares at the action the way they do. So I went on a bit of a Star Trek binge after that, and I saw the first two of the old movies.
Nice.
Which is kind of cool. The first one I'm still pissed off at, Star Trek the Motion Picture, because there seems to be about 85 minutes of people looking at screens. While they go into V'ger. It takes about twice as long as the Voyager probe took to get that far. It is atrociously bad. And I saw the second one with Ricardo Montalban in it. And then I watched Space Seed again. So I kind of went into the full Star Trek geek thing. Because the movie was coming out, all of the DVDs and Blu-rays became very cheap over here. So I picked up a few things incredibly cheaply and just kind of had a Star Trek geek thing.
I love that. We're big Star Trek geeks in our house here.
Yeah, so I kind of did that, and there's a lot of online chatter with Australians talking about it on Facebook and trying not to do spoilers so that they don't piss off their friends from other parts of the planet. it's worth seeing. I think there's a big action scene on top of a flying truck kind of thing.
Ooh.
Which may be a little bit unnecessary, but apart from that, I think it works well.
That's cool.
So what have you been up to? What have you been watching?
Let's see here. Well, It's been a crazy year for me. I've been sort of out of control with watching lots of stuff. I just rewatched a movie I hadn't seen in a long time via the Warner Archive Instant Service, which I'm a big fan of. They put a bunch of stuff on there now and some rare stuff. This movie is called Rafferty and the Gold Dust Twins. Have you ever seen this one?
Who's in it?
Alan Arkin and Sally Kellerman and Mackenzie Phillips. It's from like 1975. It's never been on DVD. So the last time I saw it was on a crappy VHS tape, pan and scan. And it's a Panavision movie, so it looks like crap, really. But basically, it's like Alan Arkin plays a down-and-out DMV employee / driving instructor who works in Hollywood. And he's on his lunch break, and he's drinking in the park, just pretty pathetic. And he runs across these two waifs,
chicks.
Yeah, drifter girls played by Sally Kellerman and Mackenzie Phillips, and they basically kidnap him and say, you know, take us to New Orleans. And it just becomes this sort of odd 70s road movie from there. And it's got a certain charm to it, and it's got three great walk-on roles from Alex Rocco, Charles Martin Smith, and Harry Dean Stanton. So
I think saying weird, what was it you said, weird 70s road movie is a bit redundant.
But that's true. There's not too many standard, you know, normal 70s road
movies.
But yeah, no, it's totally, it's got that vibe to it that's just very freewheeling, loose, you know. So that one was kind of neat to revisit after all these years, and in Panavision letterbox on the Warner Archive Service. So there was that. I'm trying to see what else here. I just rewatched. I'm sorry. This is the first time I watched this. I was watching Did you ever see the Z Channel documentary? You saw that.
I saw it a long time ago. Yeah, the Z Channel thing where they were showing all of the kind of movies that people weren't showing on TV and became a big cult thing.
Yeah, it's a cool documentary. Yeah. I was just rewatching that and listening to all the movies that people were calling out. And one of the movies that the programmer guy, Jerry Harvey, was a big fan of was this movie called The Moon's Our Home, which is something from, what year is it from here? It's a 30s movie, I believe, with Margaret Sullivan and Henry Fonda. It's from 36. And I guess they were married briefly in the early 30s, so this was post-divorce. And basically they play, it feels like not quite Preston Sturges, but sort of it's got that nice 30s comedy feel where, like, she plays a starlet in Hollywood, and he plays like a big-time author who writes travelogues, and they encounter each other on a train in the beginning of the movie, and they hear of each other, but they don't know each other, but they're both really annoyed by each other, basically because they're both egomaniacs, and they don't like the attention going to other people. So it becomes this really funny thing where they run into each other, and they still don't know who they are. And they end up sort of on this romantic getaway to this snowy cabin area. And so it's this sort of farcical thing where they, you know, obviously they finally find out who each other are, but they've still kind of got a spark between them. It's a pretty good little movie. I'd never heard of it until I saw it in the documentary. So,
oh, cool.
That's the other.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like Palm Beach Story.
Yeah, there we go. I was just trying to think. I'm like, it's like something. And Palm Beach is a good example of what it kind of is like. So anyway, yeah, that's a couple of the more recent ones I liked a lot. So.
So this other thing I want to mention, it's an episode of Armchair Theatre, an English live-to-TV show from the 1950s, and it's called I Can Destroy the Sun.
Oh, I don't know this. I've never heard of this.
It's really great. I'll have to send you a copy of it. Basically, the setup is, you know, there's nuclear tensions between America and the UK and Russia and things like that, and all of the instrumentalities, all of the countries get a little note that says, I can destroy the sun. And then another note comes saying, just to prove it, I'm going to make Phobos disappear. So they put all the telescopes over to Mars, and Phobos isn't there anymore.
Wow.
And then he says, I'm going to make an asteroid disappear. And I'll get blown up. And exactly when he predicts it, the asteroid gets destroyed. And he wants everyone to go into a big nuclear disarmament talk. and nobody knows who this guy is.
That's really cool.
And it's all done live TV, and it's fantastic. It's got a beautiful upshot in it, and it's kind of one of those little tight thought pieces. It's almost a Twilight Zone-y piece.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's great.
But it's a bit bolder than that because nobody in the Twilight Zone said, I'm going to blow up the sun.
No. No, it's got more of a hardcore political bent that I like. That's really neat.
Yeah, it's very much campaign for nuclear disarmament kind of stuff. Who's it? Morris. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. It's just a fantastic little thought piece. People stumble over lines because it's live to TV.
Wow.
And that kind of stuff. Morris Denham is one of the scientists in it. But it's just a beautiful little thought piece. And I've got another one that I've just started watching where it's kind of the first. Patrick McGoohan plays a Russian cosmonaut who's in orbit. It's very early 60s. And there's some kind of accident, and he knows he's going to die in a few hours. And the only person he can get radio contact with is a woman in a cabin in Canada.
Ooh.
Whose kid is dying of diphtheria. And this astronaut, who's a doctor, is trying to show her what to do to stop her kid dying from diphtheria in this remote cabin.
Wow. That sounds great, too.
Oh, fantastic stuff. I really am going to have to Dropbox these to you. Because
yeah, I'd love to see these. I've never heard of the show.
Very tight little dramas that are way out there. So I've been watching those as well, which is kind of fun. And I've got a book recommendation for you as well.
Lovely, lovely. What is it?
It's called Offbeat. It's Offbeat, British Cinema Curiosities, Obscurities and Forgotten Gems.
Nice.
It's edited by a guy called Julian Upton, and you can get it from Head Press, if you go to headpress.com. A friend of mine, Lucy Sussex, who's a writer, recommended it for me, and it's great. It's got all these really weird 1940s to 80s English movies. Unwin Withering and Zygo is in there.
Dying to see that one. I've been meaning to.
Yeah, all those kind of things are in there. And I've been downloading all the things I can find there just to watch these British films and just having a great time with it.
What's the book called again, Terry? What's it called again?
Offbeat, one word, OFFBEAT.
Yeah.
If you go to headpress.com,
gotcha.
You can pick up a copy. The paperback copies are a fair bit cheaper. It's in UK pounds, but they deliver to Australia pretty quickly.
Very cool.
And I really enjoyed it. I've got it beside my bed at the moment. I keep dipping into it and making notes on stuff I've got to find copies of.
It sounds right up my alley. I'm going to check it out. Thank you, sir.
That's perfectly fine. You've got to share the love with these things. But, we're going to take a break now. And when we get back, we're going to talk about – I haven't talked about what the two movies are yet. We've been having so much fun. The Mask of Demetrios, directed by Jean Nicolesco from 1944 with Sydney Greenstreet, Zachary Scott and Peter Lorre. And then we're going to have a bit of fun and tuck into Hudson Hawk from 1991.
Come closer. I have another story to tell you. Astounding. Incredible. The fabulous tale of Demetrios, an evil genius whose crimes baffled the continent for 20 years. Will-o'-the-Wisp, whose face the police had never even seen. But Demetrios hid behind many masks. An obscure peasant one day, banker the next. A man? No, a devil. Without heart or soul or conscience. I knew him only too well. But Demetrios...
A little surprised, Peterson?
Demetrios... Utterly without scruples, completely immoral, but fascinating.
I feared him, yet I loved him.
As far as I know, no government ever caught Demetrios.
And I knew I hated him enough to kill him.
Okay, we're back again, and we're going to talk about The Mask of Demetrios. Rupert, do you know that there's a character in this movie that's also in Journey into Fear?
I did not know that.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that after. Basically, it's a 1944 Warner Brothers movie, so you know it's going to be good.
And by the way, real quick, Terry, it's coming out via Warner Archive DVD next week, I think. It'll be on the 11th of May. It's been pushed a couple times, but I'm told that the master for that disc is great and better than any previous TV masters. Now, I only have a bootleg, well, not a bootleg, but a recording from Turner Classic.
That's the one I've got too, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm told that this master looks night and day way better. So that's kind of cool that this movie, that we're talking about this movie now, and it's going to be available for people to buy very soon.
Absolutely, and there are a couple of bits where there are some cuts, you know, momentary edits in the version that I saw.
Yeah.
So anyway, directed by John Nicolesco, who directed one of the great films that I love the most, Roadhouse, with Richard Widmark and Ida Lupino in it.
Which I haven't seen, ridiculously. I need to see that.
Oh, you have got to see that. It's much, much better than the Patrick Swayze Roadhouse.
I love that one too, myself. But
no, this one is a tons better.
I'm going to check it out.
Like, she plays a great chick with attitude who makes a bikini out of some scarves and all sorts of things. And sings in a nightclub, you know, out in the wilderness. And she can't sing. But she puts it across really well. But anyway, you've got to see that. Let me know what you think when you see it, because I'd be really interested to find out.
Absolutely.
And anyway,
real quick, I'm a big fan of, he did a movie called The Best of Everything. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Is that late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like maybe a slight influence on, like, Mad Men or something like that, except that...
I have seen that.
Yeah, it's like a soap opera set in an office. I think it might be an advertising agency, you know, men and women kind of interacting. It's kind of melodrama. It's pretty cheesy, but...
it's chicks, yeah.
Yeah, it's got Joan... I think Joan Crawford in the lead.
Yeah, I think she plays the hard bitch boss.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah, I saw it a couple of years ago.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
And I think he did Three Coins in the Fountain.
He did, and it's another one I haven't seen. I gotta check.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting kind of thing. Did he do the sequel as well? Let me see. John, did he do... There was a remake of Three Coins in the Fountain.
I'm looking at his IMDb right now.
Yeah.
I see one in 54. Did he do one prior to that?
Did you do the Pleasure Seekers?
Oh, he might have. I know you covered that on the show, and I watched it after you covered it.
Yeah, which is a much better version of Three Coins in the Fountain because it has Anne Margaret in it.
Anne Margaret, and who's the other girls in it? I'm blanking.
Pamela Tiffin, I think, is in there.
And the girl from Bunny Lake is missing. Why can't I think of her name right now? Carol Lindley, right?
Carol Lindley, yeah.
Yeah, I love Carol Lindley. Yeah, that was a lot of fun, that one. He did direct that, yeah.
He did, so he did basically the same movie twice. But anyway, back to the mask.
Sorry to sidetrack us, but he's an interesting...
No, I think it's fun. We're gonna do this a lot. But anyway, it's got Sydney Greenstreet, Zachary Scott, Faye Emerson, Peter Lorre, based on a story by Eric Ambler, who was one of the great early thriller writers, and directed by Nicolesco. It's in wonderful black and white. It runs 95 minutes. And I'll just give a little bit of a précis of it. Mystery writer Cornelius Leyden, played by Peter Lorre, he's actually playing a good guy in this one, becomes intrigued when the murdered body of a vicious career criminal washes up in the Bosphorus. That's what I've got.
Yeah.
That covers it.
Yeah.
And his name is Dimitrios Makropoulos,
yes,
played by Zachary Scott, who is evil.
Yeah, he's really good in this.
He is. I mean, Zachary Scott was always a bit of a second player, but he kind of had the widow's peak happening there and the pencil mustache and the lean, mean features and that kind of thing. So he kind of pulls this off pretty well.
He reminds me just a touch of Lee Van Cleef.
He does have a little bit of Lee Van Cleef, and he's got very much the same kind of facial structure,
yeah,
and things like that. But getting back to what I was saying earlier, Colonel Harkey, the guy played by Kurt Catch in the movie, the Turkish police chief, if you go back to Journey into Fear with Joseph Cotten...
Which I haven't seen that one either, ridiculously.
God. Colonel Harkey is played by Orson Welles.
Oh, wow, that's really neat.
It is really neat, and I kind of twigged onto it, and it's based on an Eric Ambler story just like this is. So obviously Ambler used the character in two different stories. But I'll just play a little bit of audio now. This is the bit on a train where... Cornelius Leyden meets a mysterious geezer called Mr. Peters, played by Sidney Greenstreet.
I must apologize for intruding on your privacy.
Oh, please, you're not intruding. This berth was not occupied.
How good of you to say so. How little kindness there is in the world today. How little thought for others. May I ask how far you're going?
I'm going to Sofia.
Oh, beautiful city, beautiful. I am continuing to Bucharest.
Oh.
I trust that we shall have a pleasant journey together.
I hope so.
allow me to smoke, please?
Please go right ahead.
You know, the moment the attendant told me that there was a Hollander on the train, I knew that I should have a pleasant journey.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so.
I'm English by birth. But actually, I'm a citizen of the world. To me, all languages are beautiful. If only men would live as brothers without hatred. Seeing only the beautiful things, but know there are always people who look on the black side.
Well, I think I'm going to sleep now.
Sleep? Great mercy vouchsafed us poor humans. My name is Mr. Peters.
How do you do? If you forgive me, I think we are getting to Sofia very early. Good night, sir.
Good night, sir.
Yep, so that's how these two guys meet. And what happens is that Layden basically hears from Colonel Harkey about the history of Demetrios Maxcropoulos and goes back and meets the people who knew him. That's got a little bit of Citizen Kane about it, do you think?
Yeah, now that you mention it, that's totally right.
And it feels a little bit like The Third Man in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you brought this movie to me.
Yeah, no, this is one that...
tell me about it.
Well, I run this series on my blog that's, you know, people's discoveries from, you know, any given year. The movies they've seen for the first time that really stood out. And I have a friend of mine who runs a great show on KCRW. His name's Eric J. Lawrence, and I've been a fan of him. He's a radio DJ, and I've been a fan of his show for 10-plus years. And he's a movie guy, too, so I've gotten him into doing these lists for me. And this was on his list, and he was really ecstatic about it, and I read the synopsis and I was like, Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre, I am there, you know, I love those guys. And so sort of a blind examination of the movie, and when I saw it I was just knocked out by it. It'll be on my list of favorite discoveries next year. I just really loved it. So,
and there's nothing quite like Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre playing off each other.
No,
they're a match made in heaven. I mean, all the way back from when they first got together in the which one was it? It was Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, I feel like this is a good sort of sister film to that, in a lot of ways, just because of the sort of back and forth and the, I don't know, it just feels like a cut of the same cloth to me.
Yeah, I agree. It's got that great Warner Brothers feel about it. And one of the things that really impressed me with the film, too, is the level of detail in the set design and the set decoration.
Yeah.
I mean, things like Sidney Greenstreet makes Peter Lorre some Algerian coffee using the little thing that they use in the Middle East to make the coffee with and things like that.
Yeah.
And they've got a little scene in a bar where they've got a spit roast pig or some kind of animal on the spit roast, and they panned across it to get to this little brief scene where someone gets arrested, and it's all beautifully detailed work.
Yeah, no, it's definitely it feels like a slightly lower budget Warner Brothers movie of that era, but still like nothing that ever pulls you out. It's just, it's really, like you say, well designed, well photographed, well acted. It's just solid,
and it's got that beautiful virtue, which is a horrible virtue to have, in that they got a lot of European actors who left Europe before the war. People like Kurt Katz, who plays Colonel Harkey. And they've got these great European faces and genuine accents.
Yeah.
And it adds so much to the film. Peter Lorre, of course, was part of that.
Yeah. No, Kurt Katz is definitely a guy I recognized, but I couldn't place him. But
he was also in Secret of the Incas with Charlton Heston.
Oh, very nice. I love that movie.
Which is a fan. Oh, yeah. Charlton Heston playing Indiana Jones as a pimp.
Yeah.
As a gigolo.
That's a great description of it. Yeah, that's totally.
It is. And with Yuma Sumac singing in the Andes and all sorts of shit.
That's a lot of fun.
But, oh, it is. And there were some weird things I noticed in this film, too. Things like they were playing Perfidia on a Balkan zither.
Very, wow.
And, you know, like they were playing modern tunes with kind of weird instruments in the background of various scenes.
Wow. Yeah, I missed that. That's great.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, this is beautiful. It's a bit like when you see, have you seen the OSS Saint-Dicep movies with Jean Dujardin, the spy spoofs?
Which ones are those? What are some of the titles?
There was OSS 117, Cairo, Nest of Spies.
Oh, no, I haven't seen those. No.
Yeah, where they kind of do old pop songs from the 1950s with a kind of Middle Eastern twist to them. It's a bit, felt a bit like that.
That's
to
a
me.
Nice touch.
It is. And they meet various people, getting back to Demetrius. They meet various people in Demetrius's life, like his ex-mistress, played by Faye Emerson, who's really good in this.
Yeah. I love that when, you know, they sit down with her to talk to her, and the minute they bring up his name, she's like, get out. Leave right now.
And they kind of convince her, and she does the flashback thing and talks about it. And you can see how the years have changed her, too, which is really good makeup work.
Yeah.
And good acting as well, because she met Demetrius 15 years before.
Yeah.
She's right. Talking to the guys. And then they meet the spy guy, the kind of rich retired spy. And the best thing I like about him, apart from the fact that he's stylish as hell and wears a cravat.
Yeah, that's nice.
He's got boy and girl cats called Helwaz and Abelard.
I missed that too.
Yeah, and they're lovers, and you think, oh yeah, well the because Abelard, Peter Abelard, obviously got castrated, and the male cat's name is Abelard.
Oh wow,
there's a kind of sly little bit of underpinning in there that I giggle at. I really did get to me.
No, I see there's more going on than I, and I've seen this thing twice now, and I missed some of this stuff. This is great.
Oh, it's just a weird kind of mind I've got. And they got that great line on paper at the start of the film, that page from the book, saying, for money, some men will allow the innocent to hang. They will turn traitor. They will lie, cheat, and steal. They will kill. They appear brilliant, charming, generous. Such a man was Demetrius.
Yeah, that's such a great stage setter, you know, perfect.
It is, and you get him from being a little bit of a kind of street urchin. What was he, a fig seller or something like that when he started out?
Yeah, I couldn't understand what they were saying every time, but yeah, that's the sense I got, was it something like that.
Yeah, so he basically, you know, schlepped fruit around the docks until we see him right at the end. It's a little bit Harry Limey, isn't it?
Absolutely, no, and that's a great moment, you know, when we do see him finally. The second time I watched it, for some reason, I almost gasped for some reason, like, and I have no idea why, because it's not, it just was like, the buildup was so great. I'm just like, yes, he's here. It was just this great moment.
But it's kind of the rule in those movies where somebody dies and then someone goes and investigates their life. About 8 times out of 10 in a movie, the guy's not going to be dead.
Yeah.
I mean, there are exceptions like The Great Man and things like that. But really, then chances are he's going to turn up at some space, and he does. And him and Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre have some great interactions.
Yeah, that last scene, last couple scenes are just dynamic, and I just love them.
Yeah, there's that bit where, you know, the guns go off. I'm going to be a bit oblique to avoid a spoiler here. And the outraged kind of legitimate man, the man who's not a criminal, attacks Demetrius.
Yeah.
Totally, you know, just in a fury at what this man does to other people. And that's just got that edge to it that I found really fascinating.
Yeah, no, and it's, and that particular performer, when he goes into that mode, is really entertaining to watch and listen to, because the noises that he makes too are great.
And very realistic. I mean, it's all there. Lorre was such an underrated actor in a lot of ways. I mean, he could bring... You go back to Emmy, of course, you can see that's the start of his career and what he brought to that.
Yeah.
And I think there's a new version of him out too, isn't there?
A new? I've got the Blu-ray from Criterion from a few years ago, but maybe there's another version even.
There's another one. I'm sure there is, but I don't know too much about it. But,
I'll buy that.
Yeah, but... I mean, Lorre was just fantastic. His real name, of course, was Laszlo Lowenstein, and which is why he changed his name to Peter Lorre, I suppose.
Yeah.
But just everything, all the way from the start at M and all those things he did in those days, all the way through to the stuff he did for Roger Corman just before he died.
Yeah, the Poe stuff.
He was incredibly entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah, I love. He's one of my favorites. He really is. And Greenstreet, too. And Greenstreet's fascinating because he came to acting so late in his life. It's just so wonderful.
He's in his 50s or something.
Yeah. It was late 50s or early 60s. And, I mean, made just a handful of films. But he's so larger than life and so great. His career feels even fuller and longer than that, you know?
I think he did a lot of stage work before he ever made a film, and he's got that background.
That makes sense.
That lets him project that let him project the way he could. And he played, you know, his characters were never all that dissimilar from one another.
No, he had a niche, and he really filled it well.
Absolutely. And I saw something recently. Oh, yeah, it was an episode of Danger Man with Patrick McGoohan.
Yes.
And you could see the guy playing one of the fat bad guys in that, channeling Sydney Greenstreet and doing a dead-on Sydney Greenstreet.
Yeah, I mean, he's got... I mean, is it been... I'm sure it's probably been explicitly said that the character of the Kingpin in the Marvel Comics feels like it's very much based on, you know, a Greenstreet type. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not been explicitly said, or maybe it has, I don't know, but I always think of that's how far and how influential his persona was to me. Or, I mean, to a lot of people, not just me.
And the other thing, too, is that particularly in this movie, his character is incredibly likable, even though he's a bit of a bastard.
Yeah. Yeah.
He engages, and even when you know he's conning you, you kind of like him for it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's some great scenes where he lies to Peter Lorre about certain things.
Everything.
Yeah, but like in particular, if he's carrying certain things or not, and then he is, and Lorre is really upset for believing him. It's just a great bits of stuff with them.
Yeah, I mean, it's great, and there's lots of little character bits in this film, too. John Abbott's in there, a character actor who did a lot of things. He was the alien guy. I think, no, he wasn't. This is another guy I'm thinking of. But anyway, he's there as the guy who's searching through the archive to find the information about Macropolis.
Oh, yeah.
And he's got this one little scene where he does this great eccentric kind of bookkeeper character, you know.
Yeah, that's a great scene, absolutely. I totally recognize this guy, yeah.
Yeah, and just those kind of things where you've got little tiny character pieces where they just let the actors shine. And I really liked that. I think Warner Brothers did that really well. I think that's one of the things, that generosity is something you see through all of the Warner Brothers stuff in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they really do allow for background players to really elevate the material by sort of giving them a moment or a couple moments. Yeah, that's the kind of movie I love. It's not just about, I mean, it's obviously it's about the star power and the certain large actors running the show and it being about them, but as you say, they did allow for those moments, and it makes for a fuller movie, and that this is one of those examples.
Absolutely, and just the kind of quality of acting they get out of people, because a lot of the people in this film, it's a bit like watching Casablanca, where half the people in the movie ran away from the Nazis.
Yeah.
Including the guy playing the head Nazi, Conrad Veidt. But yeah,
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, basically, it's got that same feel, because this is 1944. This is still, the war is happening. And one of the things I was thinking about when I was watching this was those movies like that are set in Europe and are made during World War II, they're made with a nostalgia for a place that they can't go to, because it's still the war there. The Germans still run the place.
Yeah.
And all these people knew these places really well, all the people in the film, and some of the writers and the directors and the lighting guys and the technicians knew these places, but they were inaccessible because of the war. And they were nostalgic for how these places were before the Nazis fucked everything up.
Yeah.
And that gives an intensity to them you don't get in a lot of other places.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating context that I often forget about when I'm looking at a movie. Like how that must have affected things and, as you say, created this nostalgia. That's very interesting.
That's why the scene in Casablanca with La Marseillaise is so powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's people's heart on the screen.
Yeah, that scene is one of my favorites, and moves me almost to tears on occasion still, even though I've seen the movie so many times.
That scene, that's one of the ones for me. The other one is the scene in Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, where Teo is talking about what happened to him when the Nazis took over.
Yep, that's a great one, too, and one of my favorite movies of all time, for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, these movies had an intensity because the fictional things they were talking about were happening.
Yeah.
And I think this movie kind of rolls into that a lot, that nostalgia for a lost Europe
Absolutely.
Which is marvelous stuff, even though, of course, it was incredibly horrible for the people involved.
Yeah.
You've got to see Journey into Fear as well with Joseph Cotten.
It's been on my list. It's one of those that ridiculously I just haven't gotten to, but I'm going to very soon, especially now that there's a connected thread here.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to compare Orson Welles with Mr. Clatch, but both of them do a good job on it, and both of them make the character their own.
Great.
And it's not a big film, and it's not a particularly well-known film, but the quality of the acting, the set design, the story, it drags you along too. I really like it.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that. I hope that you would, and rewatching it again today, I was like, I'm pretty sure Terry would be on board with this, so I'm glad you were.
Yeah, and I do like, I've got this real big thing at the moment for films that kind of are set in Europe when the outcome of the war was still uncertain.
Yeah.
There's something about that. There's a movie called Went the Day Well that I talked about on the podcast.
Which, since you've talked about it, I've been trying to pick up the DVD and check it out, and I haven't done that yet, but I really want to.
Oh, it's just marvelous. When they were talking, there's a kind of prologue that's set after the war, which they made while the outcome of the war was still uncertain.
Oh, wow.
And that's it takes a certain audacity.
Yeah.
And they talk about how Hitler got his and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
But, yeah, I mean, I've got I think there's an intensity to movies that were made during the war that really films made afterwards or before really don't have.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, I hadn't thought about it specifically, but you think about the 30s films, they're a lot lighter, breezier comedies. I mean, there's certainly some drama in the 30s too, but yeah, there's definitely an intensity that comes, and it's palpable, and it makes sense that it's so much about what was going on in the world at the time.
Yeah, 1939 onwards, shit got real.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, okay, so we'll take another break now, and then when we get back, we're going to go a lot lighter and funnier, and we're going to defend Hudson Hawk.
Yes.
On a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are. Or won't you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long funny ears. He kicks up at anything he hears.
His back is brawny and his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak.
And by the way, if you hate the ghost,
you may grow up to be a mule.
Or would you like to swing on a star, carry moonbeams home in a jar,
and be better off than you are?
Or would you rather be a fish? A fish is an animal that swims in a brook. You can't write his name or read a book.
To fool the people is his only thought, and though he's slippery, he still gets caught.
The fat sort of life is what you wish.
Ooh-dee-oh.
You may grow up to be a fish.
Delish.
Or would you like to swing on a star, have your moonbeams home in a jar, and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a pig? A pig is an animal with dirt on his face. His shoes are a terrible disgrace. He's got no manners when he eats his food. He's fat and lazy and extremely rude. But if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig. And all the monkeys on in the zoo, every day you see quite a few.
So you see, it's all up to you.
Be better than you are. You could be swinging on a star.
You could be swinging on a star.
You could be swinging on a star. Tommy, yes, Eddie. You could be swinging on a star.
You could be swinging on a star.
You could be swinging on a star, my man.
Hey, don't I know it?
You could be swinging on a star. You could be swinging on a star.
Let's take it home.
You could be swinging on a star.
Okay, we're back again, and we're going to have a lot of fun and talk about Hudson Hawk.
Yes.
Now, yep, Hudson Hawk is a 1991 movie. Two good Bruce Willis movies were made in 1991. I'll talk more about that later. It's a 1991 American action comedy film directed by Michael Lehman. Bruce Willis stars in the title role and also co-wrote the story. It's also got Danny Aiello, Andy McDowell, James Coburn, David Caruso, Frank Stallone, Sandra Bernhardt, and Richard E. Grant.
Yes.
And it starts out with Leonardo da Vinci, right at the start of the film, inventing a machine to turn base metals into gold. And they even throw in a Mona Lisa joke.
Yeah, that's a good one. That sets the tone real early, sort of.
Yeah, it does. And they've got William Conrad doing the voiceover.
Yeah, that is
in the fake
that, oh, that's such a great another nice touch. You know, just that attention to detail, and you hear that voice right away, and he has aged, but you can't help but think of Rocky and Bullwinkle when you hear him. Yeah. And that's another tone setter.
Yeah, he does it in a little bit of a tootsie frootsie Italian accent, but yeah, it's all good. And my favorite William Conrad role. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Cool.
Yeah. No, my favorite William Conrad role. The Naked Jungle.
Oh, yeah, he's great. That is a great movie.
Yeah, copies of The Naked Jungle, they're like $5 each in junk bins around here. I keep buying them and giving them to people. But, so basically, William Conrad does the voiceover, and they cut from Leonardo's flying machine to Eddie Hawkins, Hudson Hawk, getting out of jail and being told by his parole officer that he's got to do a robbery for him.
Yeah, I love that line. I love that line where he says there's a very fine line between ex-con and escaped con.
Yeah.
It's a great bit.
Yeah, and he's picked up by his buddy and partner, Tommy Fivetone, played by Danny Aiello. And there's a running gag through there about cappuccinos. Anything that's got coffee in a movie I'm happy with. But tell me what you like about the film.
I don't know. It's just got a really irreverent sort of sense about it, and it doesn't take itself too seriously, and they break a lot of rules in some really cool ways. I don't know, I like the musical. There's just a lot that I like about it. I love the chemistry between Aiello and Bruce Willis. Those guys together,
yeah,
just great, and they feel real, and they're funny, and they bicker in this way that's really entertaining. And I love the low tech nature of the way that they work as far as the heists go, you know, it adds some kind of authenticity, yet it's oddly, it's just funny. It's a funny thing to have going on.
Yeah, and part of it is almost social engineering, the way the guys work with
that.
Yeah, and, I mean, and the thing is that it's got so many kind of meta references.
Yeah.
Like, they've got to decide how long it's going to take to do the robbery, so they sing a song.
That's just brilliant.
Of that length.
That's brilliant.
Of that length while they're doing it, and they do Swing It on a Star with Bing Crosby in it.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that. I like that fact that they kind of harking back to the hipsters of yesteryear in a way with it and doing it. I mean, they could do a robbery where basically all they need to do the robbery is hit a few buttons on a few VCRs and ride skateboards down corridors.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my kind of robbery. I could manage that. Nearly on a skateboard, singing an old pop song from the 1950s, grabbing a Da Vinci horse.
Yeah. They just make it seem like they're having a great time, which they are.
Yeah, the escape's a little more problematic, admittedly.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, it's cartoonish and it's hipster and it's cool. I think the big problem that people had with the film at the time was there was a lot of kind of bad rumors going out about the film, the fact that Bruce Willis had to have his bald patch CGI'd out of the film, and there were some changes in roles. Andy McDowell was brought in late to play the love interest.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And there was a lot of kind of bad gossip there. And when the movie came out, it came out at a time when action films were taking themselves really seriously.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems. This is a good opportunity to talk about the other good Bruce Willis movie from 1991, The Last Boy Scout.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
It is. Shane Black script.
A very appropriate, really? Being that Iron Man 3 just hit theaters.
Well, it hit a little earlier here than
of
it
course,
did there. But,
of course it did.
But yeah, I enjoyed Iron Man 3. I mean, I love the Shane Black touches in Iron Man 3.
I still haven't seen it. My son's seen it twice. I haven't seen it yet. But yeah, I love Shane Black. I love the way that he writes, and so I'm looking forward to it. But
there's some great reverses in it, and Ben Kingsley kicks ass.
Great, great.
But yeah, you really, really do have to see it.
No, you're totally right though about as far as context and what people were expecting from a Bruce Willis movie, especially if it's sort of sold as an action movie, which I think at the time I forgot to look at the trailer, but I think they still kind of try and sell it as an action movie, and yeah, that's not going to work because that's not what this movie's about.
No, the movie's basically an entertainment, and it's got its eye clearly on that. You've got James Coburn playing the main bad guy, and well, one of the main bad guys.
Named Gabe Cap, not Gabe
George,
Cap.
George Kaplan.
Gabe Kaplan.
George Kaplan. Yeah, that's a reference to another movie, Hitchcock's North by Northwest.
Yeah.
Where the spy that didn't exist, his name was George Kaplan.
That's a wonderful, I love Dan, speaking of writers that I love, Dan Waters is one of those guys that has that sense of meta and, you know, tongue-in-cheek that not everybody appreciated or appreciates, but I think you and I are both probably fans of his stuff.
Absolutely. It's one of the more cool references are in there that most of the other people I'm sitting in the theater with don't get. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I don't mind that.
I love giggling when nobody else is giggling because I've got the joke.
Yeah, no, me too.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of that kind of stuff. So you've got those references in there. You've got the little tone that the handcuffs play, the electric handcuffs play, which is exactly the same as the one in the phones used in like Flint and Our Man Flint.
Yep.
Which is actually a speeded up version of Hail to the Chief.
Oh, very cool. I did not know that.
Yeah, kind of stuff.
No, there's tons of nice touches, though. I mean, I love the CIA goons named after candy bars, you know. I mean,
where they used to be called after diseases. And the Goombas that meet at the start of it, in the five-turn bar, the Mario brothers, Caesar and Anthony Mario.
Yeah, there's several Nintendo references. There's a Nintendo gag running through it that I think is...
Yeah, that's product placement for you. I've been in jail so long, I've never played Nintendo. That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just a lot of joy. And then you've got the main villains, the Mayflowers. Was it Minerva and... What's the guy's name?
Oh, yeah, what is his name? Richard... Darwin.
Darwin and Minerva Mayflower,
yeah.
Played by Richard E. Grant and Sandra Bernhardt, over the top, mega over the top.
Yeah.
I've actually got a little bit where they're talking about their plans. I'll put that bit of audio in here.
So, Captain Hawk, in one of your paws, you've got a gold bar worth about 8,000. In the Otra, you've got lead that won't get you gelato.
Surely a master thief like you can tell the difference.
That's one down, Kitty Carlisle.
Cool, isn't it? Weight, feel, malleability, they're all but identical. On the periodic chart of elements, they're but one proton apart. Great minds work for centuries to turn worthless into priceless.
Alchemy?
Alchemy is the business term of the 90s, my man. Minerva read about it in an airline magazine about 4 years ago. I dumped some lira into research, and shazam! We come across a diary by one of Da Vinci's assistants detailing La Macchina de Oro, the gold machine for those at home. And the rest is about to become history. Money isn't everything. Gold is. Fuck T-bills. Fuck blue chip stocks. Fuck junk bonds. We've got the real deal. Money will always be paper, but gold will always be gold.
After a couple of years of steady production, we'll flood the market with so much gold that gold itself, the foundation of all finance, will lose its meaning. Brokers, economists, fellow entrepreneurs will drown in the saliva of their own nervous breakdowns.
Sounds like a party.
Markets will crash. Financial empires will crumble.
Except yours.
So, yeah, so this is basically them. They're totally nuts. They're totally over the top. They're cartoonish, but it's fun watching actors play sometimes. You get actors that have played serious roles or are known for certain things, and watching them get playful. People like Danny Aiello, before this film, he didn't do a lot of comedy. And he has a lot of fun in this film.
Oh, he's great. He's very funny. Like I said, the repartee between he and Willis, they feel like old friends. They are just really funny to hang out with, as it were. But Richard E. Grant, are you a With Neil and I fan? I'm assuming so, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in that full, like, even beyond With Neil mode, and I love him in that mode. He's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, and he's really good in Henry and June as well.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a great writer. He writes kind of diaries about his movies that he makes.
Yeah, I really want... They mentioned that in the commentary. I think that book covers in more... I think I mentioned to you off mic that that the commentary from Michael Lehman, he sort of sticks to not, you know, being too sensationalistic about what happened. He's very... You know, this is where we filmed this, and, you know, it's not boring, but he doesn't want to go into that kind of stuff. But apparently Richard E. Grant's book goes into some detail about some more sensational stuff.
Yeah, I think it's in his book, which is called With Nails.
Yeah, that's a great title.
And we can find it around here. It's in, a lot of it's remaindered, so there are tons of copies of it lying around Australia. But it's a great read. It's a very entertaining read. And he talks about getting set up for the role, getting clothing right for all sorts of roles he does, and he takes you into the actor's life in a way that very few other people have.
That's really neat
in book form, and it's just a lot of fun seeing you do that. I really love it the way he does it.
It's a very interesting thing to think about the context of the movie, like we were talking about why it wasn't received well, and I think people were, this is something Lehman touches on in the commentary too, is that maybe this happens with actors a lot. People were kind of gunning for Bruce Willis. So, you know, he said that, you know, and I think actually there's an interview with Bruce Willis and the producer, the guy that they sort of developed the story together. And I think they all kind of echo that it was his time, basically his time to be, to be taken down. And so a lot of people were down on this movie, as still happens today, before they saw it, you know.
I think a lot of it, too, is that him and Demi Moore were recently together then, and there was a lot of publicity and paparazzi activity around them.
Yeah.
And there was talk about one of the previous actresses that was playing Anna in the film, right at the start of the film, getting a bit too close to Bruce, and they had to get Andy McDowell in.
Yeah, and that's what's funny is that Lehman does dispel that in the commentary. He says that the actress that they used had some back problems, and she thought she could make it through the shoot, but she made it about 3 days, and it was just so unbearable that they had to replace her. And so it had nothing to do with
what they said it had to do with.
Of course, yeah. It was just, you know, sensationalizing journalism.
Yeah, which doesn't serve the movie. I mean, also Joel Silver was the producer on this one, and a lot of people were gunning for Joel Silver,
absolutely,
too. He had that string of successes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there were certain people that wanted to drag him down. But I would watch a sequel to this film.
Oh, I absolutely would. I would love to see a sequel to this movie. It's such a great character.
Yeah, he is. And I think Bruce Willis lost touch with that playfulness for a lot of years until he did Red.
Yeah.
I
was going to say, he seems like it's coming back a little bit.
Yeah, I think he's got to that comfort place where he can play again. Because, I mean, he did get slammed a lot for this movie in a lot of ways, which is not cool. It was very much a personal project. Some people said it was a vanity project. But I think it was just like having a bit of fun with your mates and entertaining people.
Yeah, I feel like people get so carried away. I hope that there's some kids today that could go back and revisit it and just see it as this slice of fluffy fun, you know, just a silly, fun, almost screwball comedy. You know,
I think the hipsters could rediscover it and get a lot out of it.
I hope so.
Yeah. It's just a fun film. The effects are really effective. The location shooting in Italy is really great. They use a lot of the same buildings that you get in some things like a couple of Fellini films, for instance, and a few other bits and pieces. That big municipal office building where the Mayflowers have their headquarters in a lot of films, including Last Man in the World with Vincent Price.
Oh, very cool. That's a neat connection.
Yeah, and a fewer kind of Italian spy movies and things like that. So they're really aware of that stuff. They're very hip to that 1960s spy vibe because they've got James Coburn doing all the shit in there.
Yeah, I was going to say. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and where he's talking about doing his first barehanded strangulation there.
Yeah, I mean, there's very much in touch with the Flint movies, and then even I think he mentioned this in the commentary too, the President's Analyst, which is a neat one that people have forgotten about. But the way that they set up the Vatican in this movie feels very much like the way they set up the phone company in the President's Analyst.
Yeah, the Vatican's got a great intelligence organization to it where they get nuns to flirt with people. You're there, you're fading out a little bit.
Sorry, I love the flashing cross, you know, that that sort of alerts people to a message, an incoming message. That's great.
Yeah, and there's nice little touches like the fat guard at the Vatican Museum who's got a great big thermos full of spaghetti.
Yes, and I think Lehman said that those were Italian actors and they brought that. And I thought that was a great bit, too. That's just a lot of... He mentioned, I love the gurney chase in early on in the movie where Bruce Willis is in an ambulance and he falls out the back and he's being dragged. I guess that was influenced by the Jerry Lewis movie, The Disorderly Orderly. They looked at that film because there's a similar gurney crazy sequence in that, and that's a lot of fun.
Haven't seen that for a long time, but I kind of vaguely remember that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean. And they've got that lovely bit, too, where they knock Bruce Willis out and he falls into the bag of packing peanuts. Wakes up, climbs out of it, and looks at the Colosseum.
Yeah. This movie's
beautiful.
I was going to say that the transitions in this movie, he'll fall into a chair he falls into a chair a couple times where it's not even remotely explained or attempted to be explained. He just sort of pops into another scene and they're aware of it and it's a lot of fun. I love that. I absolutely love that.
Yeah, and there's lots of little sly bits of dialogue that don't really project themselves very well, like when they're talking about why are we waiting for this Mr. French looking motherfucking butler.
Yeah.
And unless you watch Family Affair in the 1960s, you don't really get the references to Sebastian Cabot.
Yeah, no, it's so, there's so much, it's so layered, and that's what I love about Dan Waters scripts, is that he's got character names and throwaway stuff in every single scene, it seems like. There's something.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, I was talking with Sal about this a while back, and she says, I don't get half of the references in movies that you get. And I said to her, do you still enjoy the movies? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, you haven't lost anything. It's just that I enjoyed it more.
Yeah. Yeah, it's totally one of those things that's neat about that sort of referential material, is that it doesn't take away necessarily from another person's enjoyment, but those, as you say, in on the joke, it just elevates it, and that's what I love about it.
Yeah, I mean, I love meta stuff when I get it. If it's something I don't get, like if somebody did something meta about heavy metal musicians or something ridiculous like that,
I
wouldn't care. But for me, I mean, I'm looking at Dan Waters' IMDb now. He did The Adventures of Ford Fairlane.
Oh, yeah.
Demolition Man,
mm-hmm.
which would have been a great movie without Stallone in it. And Heathers.
Yeah, I love Heathers so much.
Vampire Academy Blood Sisters.
That one I haven't seen.
That hasn't come out yet.
Oh, it's coming up. Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I remember Demolition Man. I've been to Irvine, California, and it is like Demolition Man. But yeah, I mean, this film, it's an entertainment. It's a lot of fun. People are expecting Bruce Willis to fail, so they set him up to fail to a certain extent. But I've talked about the movie to a few people when I watched it recently. And a lot of people, I threw it out on Facebook the way I do with whatever I'm watching. It always comes up on my Facebook. And a lot of people said, yeah, I love that movie. And in spite of the box office not being fantastic on it, in spite of the bad press it got, there were a lot of people who picked it up on VCR, VHS. And watched it and really like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely... I love... One of my favorite things about movies, and that's why it's hard for me when people get so excited about new movies, and I get excited about new movies too, don't get me wrong, but what's really interesting is you know, 10, 15 years down the road, are people still talking about it? Is it still memorable, you know?
Yeah, and there are so many action films that just fail that test a lot.
Oh, yeah, especially lately. They're so forgettable. They run together. And I mean, I guess it's always been sort of that way, but it's really interesting to me to see a movie like this that has taken on this new life, which seemed unlikely at the time based on its failure and its critically and financially. So I love to see the lifespan of a movie and how it plays out.
Yeah, and what you probably should do is double feature Hudson Hawk and The Last Boy Scout.
Nice.
Which shows Willis's acting chops. It's got Shane Black's beautiful reverses.
I love them.
In it, and it's even got a Wayans brother doing some reasonable acting.
That's right.
And it's got people like Taylor Negron in it, which is always a bit of fun.
And I think it's got a brief scene with one of my favorites. What's his name from The Burbs? God damn it. I'm going to have to look him up. Anyway.
It's got Billy Blanks blowing his own brains out. Right at the start. And, I really should do that in the podcast at some stage. I'll bring up The Last Boy Scout to take a look at a Shane Black film that doesn't have Mel Gibson in it.
Yeah. Are you a big fan of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
Oh, I love Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
So good, so good.
It's the best Fat Val Kilmer movie.
He is so funny in that movie. I didn't think he had it in him.
Yeah, I think if you engage him, he's one of those actors, too, that will walk through a role if it doesn't really engage him. But when it does, you can see the guy's talent.
Yeah, he just springs to life, and he has that old vibrancy that he used to have that, you know, I love so much.
From Top Secret, yeah.
Yeah, Top Secret, Real Genius.
Real Genius, Real Genius.
That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, even though I hate his haircut and that, I love
it. Very much of the time, yes.
Yeah, which is the unfortunate thing about it. So we can probably wrap this one up.
Yeah.
I really like Hudson Hawk. I've got the soundtrack CD, and I'm going to play the theme tune from it after you and I wrap this up. By Dr. John. And Hudson Hawk, people, if you haven't seen it for a little while, revisit it. Just sit back, get your popcorn and your beef jerky out, and a couple of beers, and a couple of friends around, and just have a bit of fun with it. It's really nothing more than that. They're not saving lives with this movie, but it's an entertainment and a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a place for these kind of movies that sometimes people forget. That's just the perfect thing for a certain time.
Yeah, if you don't want anything too brain strainy, just go for it and have a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
So that's about it for Hudson Hawk. And I'm going to do the feedback. I can't do the feedback while you're on the line.
Okay.
I'll wrap up your little piece of it. So plug your blog.
It is Rupert Pupkin Speaks. That's RupertPupkinSpeaks.blogspot.com, and I'm running a series of underrated comedies right now, or just lists of underrated comedies, and I've also taken to reviewing Warner Archive DVDs. That's become more of a regular thing every week, and that's exciting for me too, so check it out. I'm on Twitter too. It's Bob Freelander, BobFreelander, and I'm very active there if people want to get in touch with me that way.
Yeah, you are. Every time I go on, there's tons of stuff from you about what you're watching, what you're going to be watching, and plugging the blog too. So
yeah,
absolutely. If people want to follow me on Twitter, I rarely mention this, but you can do it either Paleo Cinema, one word, no dash, or Terry Frost, one word, lowercase, or you can even do Martian Drive-In.
Oh, you've got a Twitter for that too?
I've got a Twitter for everything.
I did not know that. I will jump on that.
Yeah, it has all the same shit as the other two Twitter feeds. But
gotcha.
A lot of people go to that one. But anyway, Rupert, thank you very much for coming on, mate. As I said to you offline, I really respect your movie knowledge and the breadth that you bring to it and the blog itself. I think from about 18 months ago, I owe you an article.
I would take it anytime you want to do it, Terry, anytime.
Okay, that's a date.
And thank you so much for having me. We've been communicating for years, and I've been a fan of the show for years, so this is really neat to finally you know, we've sort of talked about this for a long time. It's just a matter of scheduling, and I'm glad we were able to set it up. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. It's like Willy Wonka said, lots of surprises, but nothing dangerous.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thanks, Ruben. I really appreciate it. I'll let you get on with your day because it's very early for you and very late for me.
Yes.
And I really would like to get you on again at some stage.
And I would love to do it. Absolutely. Count me in.
Well, my people will talk to your people.
Sounds good. It sounds good.
Okay, well, take care, mate. Okay. And thanks again.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to play the Dr. John version of the theme to Hudson Hawk at the end of the podcast. But now it's time for the little bit of feedback that we got. Just play a little cool music there to ease us into it, and then I'll soften that off a little bit. Okay, I got feedback from a new listener, Ian Fryer, and thanks for that, Ian. Ian's going through the back catalogue of Paleo Cinema, which is something that I'm a bit reluctant to do myself, even though some of it's about 5 years old now. Ian says, finally caught up with Paleo Cinema in episode 5 and the Journey to the Far Side of the Sun review. It was really nice to hear someone talking about this film, and I agree with many of your comments. Especially agree that the ending was just too much of a downer, and this probably damaged the film's box office, leaving audiences depressed. I actually quite like Roy Thinnes' performance, but Patrick Weimark steals the film. I regard the first half of the film as an SF reimagining of Weimark's TV series The Power Game. He poached several cast members both for this and for UFO, which was Gerry Anderson's favourite series at the time. Gerry was especially interested in making boardroom and political dealings interesting on screen, which really comes across here and in some of the episodes of UFO. Universal financed the film, which I always called Doppelganger, it's easier to type, then sat on it for a year before releasing it, like it was on the witness protection program. I love it anyway. Yeah, thanks for that one. You know, yeah, I liked it too. I saw it years ago, of course, and it's very much different from the usual run-of-the-mill Gerry Anderson stuff that we've had prior to that, all of the puppet stuff and things like that. He really was trying to stretch things in a more grown-up way. I don't know whether... I kind of have the view that, and you may disagree with this, that things like Space 1999 were a step backwards from that. I think that he did get good actors in it, but the scripts were, in general, pretty atrocious. And I think that's... Space 1999 suffered for that. But yeah, I mean, people should revisit Journey to the Far Side of the Sun. It's really interesting. The effects, the model effects in particular, are superb, as they have been in everything Gerry Anderson did. And yeah, it's kind of got that old conceit on, you know, an alternate Earth sitting in the opposite orbit around the sun, all that kind of thing. But leaving aside that conceit, I think it's a noble attempt. But yeah, the ending was a bit too much of a downer there. They could have taken it, there are about four or five different ways they could have taken it, which would have had in some ways a stronger and a better ending for the movie. But downer endings in science fiction films are something that we're all used to, going really far back. It way predates even Planet of the Apes. But, yeah, well, thanks for that, Ian. That's pretty much the feedback that we've got this time around. I think that maybe some people have got the old voicemail number. So I'm just going to go and grab that now and give it to you because I can remember it off the top of my little head. But it has changed because the problem with these numbers is if you don't use them for 30 days, they lapse. And people can send voicemails to them and they're no longer relevant, which is a real pain in the ass with that sort of thing. And I've got to see if I can find a way around that. But they're giving it to me for free, so that's kind of what I will have to put up with, unfortunately. So the voicemail number in the US is 206-309-4864. I'm going to repeat that, 206-309-4864. So use that one in future, and these problems should no longer recur. So that's all. I will be back in 4 weeks' time with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 2 weeks' time with another Martian Drive-In podcast. Enjoy your movie watching. Sal's outside watching Eurovision at the moment, and Eurovision is deeply and disturbingly weird at times, and I'm going to go out and check it out a bit later. But anyway, take care of yourselves, keep watching good and bad films. I'm about to go off a little bit later, and I've just picked up a couple of Blu-rays with some gambling winnings, which always sounds really posh, but it basically means I went out to dinner with the Outlaws, put $20 into a poker machine and got $80 back, so I bought Blu-rays with it. So I'm going to be watching Amelie and Leon, the professional, with the Jean Reno flick directed by Luc Besson. So that's going to be a little bit of fun for me. Anyway, take care of yourselves. I'll be back very, very soon.
Nickel in his pocket, time on both his hands, little Eddie Hawkins lost in candy land. 10 years in the slammer, Eddie's done his time. On the street, ain't it sweet to pull the perfect crime? Everybody knows when the cold wind blows, the Hudson Hawk again. Let it rain, let it snow, let the north wind blow, the Hudson Hawk, my friend. Ooh, little Eddie, you better watch out, better watch out what you do. The Hudson Hawk's with you. Come Sunday, Eddie needs a friend. Tom is at the Five Tone, 49th and 10. Killers count his footsteps. Tom is dressed in black. A hustle here, a shuffle there. Eddie better watch your back. Everybody knows when the cold wind blows, the Hudson Hawk again. Let it rain, let it snow, let the north wind blow, it's a Hudson Hawk, my friend. Ooh, Eddie, you better watch out, better watch out what you do. The Hudson Hawk's with you. Listen up, all you sinners. This ain't no time to hesitate. When bad news gets around, someone's going down, and everybody better get their story straight. Broke a holy vow, needs a local hero to turn this thing around. Eddie, don't be clever, you know crime don't pay. She's a big risk, little sis, now don't you steal her heart away. Everybody knows when the cold wind blows, it's the Hudson Hawk again. Let it rain, let it snow, let the north wind blow, it's the Hudson Hawk, my friend. Ooh, little Eddie, you better watch out, better watch out what you do. The Hudson Hawk's with you. Hudson Hawk's with you. Down.
down on 49th and 10 to Hudson Hawk again. Better put my eyes in the back of your head, Hudson Hawk, my friend. Hudson Hawks for you. When a cold wind blows, if it rain, if it snows, the Hudson Hawk again.
Everybody knows when the cold wind blows.